of knowing.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is episode 639, hour one. Jason Lindgren is with me, and we're going to talk about, I guess this amounts to an oxymoron, Jason, the history of the intelligence agencies, but there's really nothing intelligent about this if life and human beings matter, because everything that these guys do is a self-centered approach, I would estimate. I mean, you wrote the notes. What's your take on it?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. They're definitely self-centered and self-serving.
I mean, to a fault, I think we would be hard-pressed to find many things that have been beneficial to society in general. But anyhow, let's jump right in.
So what is an intelligence agency? It is a government agency that is responsible for the collection, analysis, and exploitation of information in support of law enforcement, national security, military, public safety, and foreign policy objectives. The means of information gathering are both overt and covert and may include espionage, communication interception, cryptanalysis, cooperation with other institutions, and evaluation of public sources. The assembly and propagation of this information is known as intelligence analysis or intelligence assessment. The concept of gathering information to assist in decision-making goes back to the dawn of human societies.
You know, it almost feels to me like this needs to be redefined, what it actually means, because I think we used to consider that they were working for a government or something. And at this point, it almost feels like they're self-functioning, self-important, and holding the power for themselves. And I think the key word that you just laid down in the definition is exploitation. They actually ran, and I wasn't even aware of this, apparently on 60 Minutes, I didn't see it, they ran some Mossad agent who basically on camera, in disguise, said, "We run the world. All the world's a stage, and we are the directors, the writers, the creators, all of it. And the world is our playground, and we are in control of this." And it was supposedly talking about Mossad, I think. And that was openly put out on 60 Minutes.
From what I've been able to gather, it's several agencies that have pretty much gotten completely and utterly out of control. And they serve themselves, but still leech off of the government that they're supposed to be working for.
I mean, I even wonder about that at this point. Or do they have so much leverage that they basically push the decision makers that we see in any direction they want? As a matter of fact, I wonder if there's a common idea of how this pyramid actually goes together, who is truly at the top. And I know there are many people who have put these things forward, but I'm talking just about what we call intelligence agencies.
While not a reference to a specific agency, one of the oldest documented cases of intelligence activity comes from ancient Egypt during the reign of Thutmose III, from 1479 to 1425 BC, which occurred during the New Kingdom's 18th dynasty. Thutmose III, who was often called the Napoleon of Egypt because of his military prowess, conducted 17 campaigns into the Levant, which is detailed in the annals of Thutmose III, being inscribed on the walls of the Temple of Amun at Karnak. Around the year 1457 BC, during his campaign against the Canaanite coalition at the Battle of Megiddo, Thutmose employed what we might recognize as intelligence operatives. The annals describe how, before the battle, Thutmose faced a strategic decision about which of three routes to take through the Aruna Pass to reach Megiddo. The first was a narrow, risky path. The other two were wider, safer ones. The Canaanite coalition expected him to choose the easier routes and positioned their forces accordingly. However, Thutmose sent scouts, who are most likely trusted military agents or local informants, to assess the terrain and the enemy dispositions. While the text doesn't name any specific individuals, it does note that he received detailed reports about the paths, which led him to choose the narrow route as a surprise maneuver. His army emerged directly into the plain of Megiddo, which caught the enemy off guard and secured a decisive victory.
You know, we still say all roads go to Rome, but sometimes it feels like all roads go to Egypt. And we're pulling this from a false history. So go figure. And where does the false history come from? Probably from places like so-called intelligence agencies, right? Unbelievable where we have reached in the modern era. But I don't think there's probably ever been a time when espionage and things like that weren't going on.
I would tend to agree with that. After all, why wouldn't you do it?
Well, power corrupts and absolute power absolutely corrupts. So anytime you have a society putting together, there's usually someone in charge, and that someone usually wants to keep power. And we are told in our false narrative of history that usually that was families and that it tended to be handed down in families. But we're also told that people were de-seated or removed and their position taken. And all of that points towards the need for what we're talking about.
According to the biblical narrative, the Israelites escaped slavery in Egypt under Moses' leadership and are encamped in the wilderness of Paran, near the borders of Canaan, or modern-day Israel, Palestine, and parts of Lebanon and Jordan. This is thought to have occurred roughly 40 years after the Exodus, which is traditionally dated to the late 13th or early 12th century BCE. At God's command, Moses is to select 12 men, one from each of the 12 tribes of Israel, to spy out the land. These men are described as leaders or heads of their tribes, which suggests that they were trusted figures with skills suited for the task. The mission's objective is to gather actionable intelligence about Canaan, which God has promised to the Israelites as their inheritance. The reconnaissance mission is both practical, to assess the land's resources and defenses, as well as symbolic, in testing the faith and resolve of the Israelites. The spies are said to have spent 40 days exploring Canaan, traveling as far north as Rehob, near modern-day Lebanon, and south to Hebron. There, they are said to have observed the land's richness, fortified cities, and diverse peoples, which included the Anakim, who were a reputedly tall and formidable group. The spies return with a cluster of grapes said to be so large that it requires two men to carry, along with pomegranates and figs, which is to symbolize the land's fertility. They also present their findings to Moses, Aaron, and the Israelite community. They confirm that the land is flowing with milk and honey, which is a biblical idiom for abundance, but also highlight several challenges. This mission is one of the earliest recorded examples of a structured intelligence operation. Moses' clear directives to assess the land, people, and defenses mirror modern intelligence objectives of gathering data, analyzing threats, and informing strategy. The selection of one representative per tribe suggests a deliberate effort to ensure broad representation and legitimacy, which is akin to coalition building in later intelligence networks.
You know, it strikes me, these are some of the oldest tales we're ever going to hear, and they're always painting a picture that human beings treat one another poorly. In this case, they see, oh, this is a land of milk and honey, so we're going to go take it. But the thing that strikes me more is if any of this happened even close to what's being described here, there's always been a Mossad.
Moving up to the 5th century BCE, we come to Sun Tzu and the book attributed to him, The Art of War. The book is a concise treatise of 13 chapters, which blend philosophy, strategy, and tactics. While its exact composition date is debated, circa 500 to 400 BCE, it reflects the era's emphasis on outmaneuvering rivals through cunning rather than brute force. The final chapter, The Use of Spies, Chapter 13, explicitly addresses intelligence gathering, which makes it one of the earliest systematic treatments of espionage. Sun Tzu argues that spies are indispensable for victory, stating, quote, "What enables the wise sovereign and the good general to strike and conquer and achieve things beyond the reach of ordinary men is foreknowledge." There are five types of spies described. Local spies, natives who provide insider knowledge of terrain or local politics. Inward spies, enemy officials or insiders recruited to leak information. Converted spies, enemy agents returned to serve the recruiter's cause, also known as double agents. Doomed spies, agents sent to spread false information, often sacrificed to mislead the enemy. And surviving spies, trusted operatives who return with reliable intelligence.
You know, I think we need to add two more spies to this list. Where do cameras fit in? So much of the spying that goes on today is done through cameras and digital information. But this book, I would recommend everyone grab a copy and read it. It's got a lot of interesting stuff in it, and it's not very big. I remember I bought my father a copy when he was going to take part in the local government. But yeah, think about it. They're outlining how many kinds of spies there are. There are at least two new kinds of spies due to the technological age that I can think of.
In 327 BCE, Alexander the Great, during his expansive conquests, was deeply engaged in his campaign against the Persian Empire and its remnants, as well as local resistance in regions like Bactria, India, and Sogdiana. Alexander needed precise intelligence to anticipate Persian loyalist counterattacks, navigate unfamiliar terrain, and manage local alliances. To this end, Alexander employed prodromoi, or cavalry scouts, as well as local guides to gather real-time intelligence on enemy positions and terrain. In 327 BCE, as he crossed the Hindu Kush into Bactria, scouts likely mapped routes and identified water sources, which would be critical for his army's survival. To monitor local populations, Alexander recruited or coerced tribal leaders, merchants, and defectors. In Sogdiana, he used informants to track Spitamenes' guerrilla tactics, which relied on hit-and-run attacks. Former Persian officials, who would be familiar with the empire's bureaucracy, provided insider knowledge. While Alexander lacked a formalized intelligence agency, he did delegate trusted companions like Ptolemy or Hephaestion to oversee covert operations. These agents are said to have infiltrated local communities or bribed officials to gain insights. Alexander would also, on occasion, spread disinformation to confuse his enemies, such as feigning retreats to lure rebels into ambushes. Alexander's campaigns, which included his spy networks, would become legendary and helped to shape later military treatises, as well as inspiring figures like Julius Caesar, who would adopt similar reconnaissance tactics.
Can you imagine if some of these places have an accurate history and all that data, now feeding that data to AI and literally being able to show over all these centuries, if not millennium, what was effective in their strategies and what wasn't? But it always strikes me as an example here, they're talking about, you know, we got to go out and get information. When I was in the military, the same was true. Always go for the high ground for a number of reasons. But part of the high ground is because you can see everything. And that made me think about balloons. If you go on a search engine right now and look up balloons, I think it's maybe the 1600s or 1700s they're going to try to claim when the first balloons, I think it's France. I haven't looked at this in a while. But how can that be true? You're telling me all these old cultures didn't realize that heat rose, and the moment they realized heat rose, that they could start to make balloons, and for that matter, airships. There are so many people out there who have found evidence and made claims that airships have been removed from our history, and I think there's truth to it because I view the Hindenburg as another 9/11 type event. But getting back to the point, wouldn't you imagine that balloons were part of this? I mean, I know I'm a little off track here, but doesn't that story strike you as funny, Jason, the balloon story?
I think there's more to it than we see, but there's a lot of impracticalities as far as the commercialization of hot air balloons.
Right, I agree, but I did notice in some modern Hollywood movies, they're now putting balloons in old times that where they weren't supposed to be. And actually, I'm pulling us a little off track, so let's pull back around. The reason I brought this up is because I've thought about covering airships and balloons, because the timeline we're handed doesn't work.
In the first century AD, the Roman Empire developed rudimentary intelligence networks from what were known as the frumentarii, who had begun as logistical officers attached to legions and were responsible for securing and distributing grain supplies. They would have been stationed at castra, or military camps, and would have interacted with local populations, which gave them access to grassroots information. Under Augustus, the frumentarii started taking on scouting duties, which leveraged their mobility and local contacts. By the reign of Tiberius, they were being tasked with covert surveillance, reporting on potential dissent among soldiers, senators, or provincial elites. Their official base was the Castra Peregrina in Rome, a hub for provincial troops, which became a center for coordinating intelligence by the late 1st century AD. By the late 1st century, under Domitian, around 81 to 96 AD, frumentarii occasionally even served as assassins or arresting officers, targeting disloyal governors or rebels, which foreshadowed their later notoriety as imperial enforcers. The frumentarii represent one of the first institutional efforts to integrate military and political intelligence under a centralized authority, which is a hallmark of empire-wide governance.
Which Rome would be the epitome of, I would estimate. But, I mean, do you suppose that this is some of the stuff that's down in the Vatican basement? All the true information about all the things that happened behind the walls, under the table, back in these days, what was effective, the secrets that were employed, particularly for espionage and spying and things like that. I mean, they wrote a lot of things down. You got to imagine that someone has it somewhere.
Because it's Rome, I would strongly suspect that whatever system they had set up, it has been modeled in some way in the modern era and just adjusted for the technology.
Beyond doubt. I mean, we say it often. The empire did not fall. It just converted itself into, you know, what we see now. And there are still families that claim they can show their lineage back beyond that, even all the way back to Babylon, supposedly.
In the 7th century AD, the Byzantine Empire, which was the eastern continuation of the Roman Empire, was refining its intelligence-gathering capabilities to navigate a rather precarious geopolitical landscape. They faced threats from the Sassanid Persian Empire and the expanding Arab caliphates, as well as internal challenges. So, the Byzantines leveraged diplomats, merchants, and other agents to collect critical information on neighboring powers. This sophisticated, albeit informal, intelligence network marked a significant evolution from the earlier Roman practices that we just mentioned. The Byzantines lacked a centralized intelligence agency along the lines of modern counterparts, but they did maintain a flexible, multi-layered system that was coordinated by imperial officials. There were several key institutions, such as the Logothetes, who were civilian administrators, such as the Master of the Post, who oversaw communications and diplomacy, and also doubled as intelligence coordinators. There were the Tagmata, who were elite military units, which included scouts and couriers who gathered battlefield intelligence. And there was the Bureau of Barbarians, which was an earlier office that would be phased out by the 7th century, but was quite influential, that tracked foreign tribes and set a precedent for monitoring neighbors. They also had multiple other key agents, like clergy, defectors, and exiles, diplomats, and merchants. All of these were a refinement from the frumentarii of the 1st century AD, who were primarily military scouts, as the Byzantine system integrated civilian and diplomatic channels, which reflected a broader approach to intelligence.
You know, you don't really think about intelligence and the way we're covering it and how far back it goes and how much experience and all the things that must have been learned. But now imagine adding all that with AI now as a strategic effort to do things. It's quite chilling when you think about it. We're barely getting glimpses of what can be done, but clearly these places back in the day had many successes. We know they did because there were supposed empires. As a matter of fact, empires big enough to cover up many portions of the history that we know were there that we're reasonably sure have not been described properly. And you have to be able to set that box at the feet of basically what we're talking about, intelligence agencies.
I was quite impressed while looking for all this information on just how integrated in the concept of intelligence was into these very old empires and kingdoms and all that.
Some of the most ingenious things you'll ever see are going to be like old Chinese things. Like, have you ever seen, I forget what they call it, there's a teapot where he used it to assassinate important people. It had three holes on the handle and it had three chambers inside. Depending on which hole you covered with your thumb when you were pouring, it determined whether you were pouring the poison or a glass of tea. So you could literally serve five people and target one guy at the table to take them out. It was so ingenious, and all of it is based on natural science, natural ideas. And again, you've got to imagine that there are modern day places that have access to that information, what was done back then, and combining it up with the tools of today. I mean, you could start to get the impression that it's almost unbeatable at this point, but I don't choose to take that point of view.
Moving to the 13th century, we have the Mongol Empire under the leadership of Genghis Khan around 1206 to 1227 and his successors, who developed an extensive and highly effective spy network to support its rapid expansion across Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. This network is said to have gathered intelligence on trade routes, enemy fortifications, and political dynamics, which enabled the Mongols to conquer and govern a vast empire that stretched from the Pacific to the Caspian Sea. While the Mongols lacked a centralized intelligence agency, they did integrate espionage into their military and administrative systems. Intelligence was coordinated by commanders, Noyans, and trusted advisors under Genghis Khan's direct oversight. The Keshig, an elite imperial guard, served as a hub for couriers and scouts, some of whom would double as spies. The Yam system, which was a network of postal relay stations, facilitated rapid communication that enabled spies to relay reports across thousands of miles. The Mongols also utilized many key agents, including defectors and locals, diplomats, merchants, nomadic tribes, and scouts. The vast Mongol network spanned its extensive empire, with agents operating from Korea to Persia. Its decentralized nature allowed the flexibility needed to adapt to the varying local conditions.
This particular period, to be fair, many people are questioning how accurately this has been laid down, all the way down to the supposed Great Wall of China, where people will make the argument that it's facing the wrong way to back up the story we've been told. But you can imagine the power in espionage and intelligence gathering back in the day, particularly when you're painted a picture like this, where they can take whole families, whole towns, on pain of death. Yeah, you're going to get a lot of information that way, probably.
The way Genghis Khan in that whole time is painted, you really wouldn't associate it with thinking through things like having intelligence gathering and plotting and things like that. It's really portrayed as more as just being barbaric, but it apparently was just not the case.
Well, in some ways, there's almost two versions we're presented with. One is the barbaric route where you do this or you die. And the other one was more like the tale we're told about Rome sometimes. We'll take you over, but if you cooperate, you can have your same religion, your language, and all these other things. But then it starts to beg simple questions, like really, if a group took over this much area, how did they deal with the language problem, for one thing? But I'm reasonably sure we have not been given an accurate picture of these times, and that it serves as part of the cover-up for what actually happened beyond our view, which is very short, 100, 200 years, maybe with any accuracy, hard to tell.
As far as the language is concerned, I'm pretty sure they just enforced it on conquered peoples.
Yeah, that was the point I was making. We are told stories like with Rome, where, yeah, if you cooperate with us, you can pretty much live as you want, pay tribute, and follow our rules. And then the other story that we're told is they put a sword up and say, do what we say or you're gone. There's also stories where you're told they took all the males and did away with them.
In the 15th century, certain European states, particularly the Republic of Venice, began formalizing intelligence gathering through their diplomatic corps, which marked a significant step towards structured state espionage. The Venetian Council of Ten, which was a powerful governing body, oversaw covert operations to safeguard the city-state's extensive trade interests, protect its political stability, and counter rival powers like Florence, Milan, and the Ottoman Empire. One rather interesting feature of Venice's system was the Bocca di Leone, the mouth of the lion, where anonymous tip boxes, shaped like lion's mouths, were placed around the city to allow citizens to secretly denounce others. This created one of the earliest examples of institutionalized surveillance culture, allowing the state to gather intelligence from the public itself. This system, which was rooted in Venice's commercial and maritime dominance, represents one of the earliest examples of a state institutionalizing intelligence as a tool of governance. To gather their required intelligence, the council coordinated a network of informants, diplomats, and covert agents, with no formal agency, but certainly a clear hierarchy. Subcommittees, like the Inquisitors of State, which would be formalized later but was active in an embryonic state by the 15th century, handled sensitive operations. Archives, which were stored in the Cancelleria Segreta, or Secret Chancellery, recorded intelligence reports, which showcased early bureaucratic sophistication. They also utilized numerous key agents, such as ciphers and couriers, covert operatives, diplomats, numerous informants, and merchants. The Venetian model would go on to influence Renaissance and early modern espionage, which would shape European intelligence traditions.
Man, you know, just centering in on Venice, and, you know, we've had people on that draw the line all the way back to Phoenicia. That's a long time prior. But anytime you see a group in power using intelligence in this way, they're clearly stating they don't care about the people they're supposedly governing. We've seen it over and over, the brown shirts from the supposed Nazi tale. How about the way children were used in China during the big revolution there? Versions of this sprouted up for us during COVID, though most people don't realize it. When we went out during COVID, I was thrown out of so many places because I wasn't going to cover my breath because I know it's my spirit. And who was throwing me out? It wasn't the police, wasn't the authority. It was society itself trying to police me, trying to force me to do something. And that's an extension of exactly what we're talking about.
Now, since we're talking about Italy and we're all the way up into almost the Renaissance time, what is Rome doing, particularly the Vatican? You're going to tell me that they weren't involved with tons of intelligence gathering? When you have the Vatican controlling the major religion of the Western world, they're going to have their people everywhere. Why? Because they're the clergy. Of course they're going to be there.
Well, we get some pretty shocking views occasionally. There's a film, an old film called Black Robe, where it shows, it paints the story of one of the first Jesuits here interacting with the supposed American Indians. But it's exactly what you're saying. And we have covered times when the Jesuits were thrown out of so many places, but yet we know that the Vatican's been here for a long time and it's still here. So it underscores what they did and how they succeeded, because they haven't gone away. But consider the Jesuits coming into a place. What are we talking about? This is intelligence. They're spreading control. They're coming into a place, maybe where they don't even speak the language. This is what always blows my mind. And a year or two later, they've got the Bible written in the local dialect. And within 4, 5, 10 years, they have real spiritual controls in so many places. And you can't tell that tale without the idea of intelligence.
Well, the Catholic religion was absolutely weaponized on so many people. They were conquered, and then that religion forced upon them.
Still is.
In the 1530s, King Henry VIII is the King of England, which was undergoing a tumultuous period of religious and political upheaval that was being driven by the English Reformation. To consolidate his power and enforce the break he made from the Catholic Church, Henry VIII relied on his chief minister, Thomas Cromwell, to establish a network of informants that was tasked with monitoring Catholic dissent and foreign threats. Now, what was it we were just talking about?
Exactly.
This intelligence system, while informal and a bit loose compared to later agencies, was pivotal in suppressing opposition, securing the Tudor monarchy, and navigating Henry's numerous European rivalries. Henry VIII's desire to annul his marriage to Catherine of Aragon had led to England's break with Rome, which means Vatican control, being formalized by the Act of Supremacy in 1534, which declared Henry the supreme head of the Church of England. This move sparked massive dissent in his kingdom, as well as provoking other countries that were still loyal Catholics, like France and Spain. Because of the tense situation, Henry required information to identify and neutralize Catholic conspirators, monitor public sentiment, and track foreign schemes, especially from the exiled Reginald Pole, a Catholic cardinal who was plotting against him. Thomas Cromwell recruited a diverse web of spies, drawing from the clergy, court servants, local gentry, and merchants. Cromwell also had agents abroad, using diplomats and expatriates to track English exiles, such as Reginald Pole in Italy, and assess Spanish or French intentions. Cromwell would also question suspects himself, using confessions to expand the network, which was almost certainly in the hundreds of individuals. Cromwell's informants gathered gossip in churches, markets, and taverns, and would report on seditious talk, such as praising the Pope. His agents also infiltrated Catholic networks, posing as sympathizers to identify plotters. Letters from regional officials would detail local unrest, forming a grassroots intelligence feed. All in all, Cromwell's network enabled King Henry to enforce the Reformation, dismantle Catholic institutions, and centralize power, which reshaped England. Cromwell's system of reliance on informants and covert methods laid much groundwork for later English intelligence that would come under Elizabeth I.
Well, here we have a family line, right, inheriting whatever happened, but how would it have even been? I mean, think about what we're talking about here. You've got a religion which is all over the world. It is part and parcel of England at that point, and then someone decides to change it. Can you imagine how many people tried to hold on to the religion they were used to? But I think it pretty much demonstrates they had the best intelligence and the toughest reactions that could ever be imagined. Otherwise, how could they possibly have survived otherwise? And again, that was a royal line. So almost certainly the people that followed were aware of everything that was done there. But to take an overwhelmingly popular religion and then change it in your country and have enemies on top of that, I mean, you pretty much had some incredible intelligence networks, to say the least.
This also backs up what we were saying earlier, that clearly the Vatican and the extensiveness of the Catholic Church had its people everywhere and was doing its bidding. It was much, much more than just a religious organization.
Well, consider, so we're here in 1530 when you start illustrating this part of his story. It's going to be 1611 when the very book, the Bible itself, is rewritten under the control of the monarchy here. So it's not even 100 years later. So that's how effective whatever went down here was.
We now go a few decades later into the 1570s with Queen Elizabeth I now sitting on the throne. Sir Francis Walsingham, Elizabeth's principal secretary from December 20th, 1573, until his death on April 6th, 1590, establishes England's first structured intelligence service, which is considered a groundbreaking development in the history of espionage. England was still in a turbulent era because of the actions of Henry VIII. There were still Catholic conspiracies about, along with the looming threat of Spanish invasion. And so Walsingham, as Secretary of State and considered the Queen's spymaster, began crafting a sophisticated network of spies, informants, and codebreakers to protect the Protestant queen and her realm. His use of ciphers and covert agents not only thwarted domestic plots, such as those that involved Mary, Queen of Scots, a Catholic claimant to the throne, but also played a pivotal role in defeating the Spanish Armada seeking to invade England and replace Elizabeth in 1588. Among Walsingham's key collaborators was an interesting fellow named John Dee, a polymath whose cryptographic and scholarly expertise enriched the network's capabilities. This intelligence system, that was built on the foundations of the earlier efforts we have discussed, marked a leap toward professionalized statecraft. Central to Walsingham's success was his mastery of cryptography, a field where John Dee's contributions are considered invaluable. John Dee, who was a mathematician and occultist already trusted by Elizabeth for casting her coronation horoscope, brought his expertise in ciphers to bear in the 1570s. Dee had traveled Europe in the 1560s, cultivating contacts among scholars and rulers, which provided Walsingham with a conduit for foreign intelligence. His work on codes, possibly inspired by his esoteric book Monos Hieroglyphica, helped secure communications and crack enemy ciphers. Dee's dual role as scholar and spy, in which he often operated under the guise of intellectual exchange, exemplified this era's blending of knowledge and espionage, which was a step beyond the blunt interrogations of Cromwell's time.
So let's call a spade a spade. We're talking about the occult here. In my view, the Vatican had probably already been doing this for quite some time. How is it that these small places, look at the size of England, we're told they control most of the world at times, and we're told these days they still do, or the three city states. How did those little places control so many people? And here's where the occult ideas start to enter the timeline they're willing to talk about. What are they doing? They're doing things that I don't want to know anything about. They've gone to the dark side. And how could they not? If you're going to do things that are against the people that you're supposed to be governing, isn't it only a matter of time before you're going to go Darth Vader? I mean, think about the picture they're painting here. They're telling you that a king came along, said the religion we've all been doing forever, that's out. I'm replacing it with this other thing I want because I don't want to be married anymore, or that's part of the reason, and then begins to implement it. Under 100 years later, they rewrite the very book. But in the meantime, we're told that a whole country wanted to invade them. Why? Because their intelligence was probably telling them that country's in disarray. They're internally fighting each other and knocking off their own citizens. And yet, not only do they control their own citizenry, they fend off a Spanish invasion. So what's the secret? I would guess it's the same secret that the Knights Templar were taking. They had gone to the dark side. Whether you want to call it demons or black magic, they had other things that they were bringing to bear. That's my view of this whole thing.
Another thing to consider is these people who were scholars, who were well-read, that wasn't a common thing. So they would move around from place to place, city to city, country to country, and they could be used for other purposes while they were going and doing their studies.
Well, this always brings up in my mind one of the biggest problems, because in my life, if I could just make a flat decision, whether I want to be good or bad, I want to be good. But look what history shows us. Can you imagine these guys, you know, doing demonology or whatever it is they were doing that I don't really want to know about? All the people that were truly religious trying to do what they felt was good, true, and correct. And they're immediately disadvantaged because the other side doesn't give a damn about what's good or what's bad. All they want is power. And we've seen this over and over. Consider Tibet, right? A whole culture built on supporting a religion. And it doesn't even matter what you feel about the religion. The whole place was geared towards spiritual concerns. And China marched over them and barely broke a sweat. And this is the problem in the modern world, where we're all concerned with maintaining decency and good, yet what we're trying to fend off could care less about such things.
When you're talking about occultism, as far as I understand it, that was a no-no under the Catholic Church and probably under the Protestant Church as well. Yet we know for assumedly a fact that people like John Dee were very much involved with some crazy stuff. So you got to wonder, how is it that they were being allowed to be into this kind of stuff and not be persecuted for it under the religions of the time? And it's probably because they were more important to what was going on at the time and were almost certainly protected by people in power.
We have a cliche for that. Power corrupts, and absolute power absolutely corrupts. I've mentioned it a few times. There is a European version of the papal reign of Alexander, also known as Borgia. At the end, where he dies, they do a whole big scene to show how afraid everyone was of that corpse. They put it in like five caskets, and the last one's lead-lined. His lover at the time, which was a Farnese, by the way, that's one of the names that probably goes all the way back to Babylon. His girlfriend is saying, was this guy ever a human being? I don't know how a 1 mile by 1 mile city state controls that much of the world without a secret weapon. And it's exactly what we're talking about. You're putting forward a religion where people are being taught, turn the other cheek, do what you know to be right. All these things about decency, and the very people in control have gone so far the other way. It is my point of view that no matter how bad I feel like I have it infinitely better than those supposed people in charge, because it is my point of view they're slaved out by the forces that they have brought to bear to try to control everyone else.
And for the last point for hour one, moving to the 17th century, we will now take a look at the country of France. Cardinal Richelieu, chief minister to King Louis XIII from 1624 to 1642, developed a centralized intelligence system known as the Cabinet Noir to intercept and decrypt diplomatic correspondence. The Cabinet Noir enabled Richelieu to monitor foreign ambassadors, rival powers, and even domestic nobles, all to help ensure French dominance during a period of intense European conflict, which included the 30 Years' War from 1618 to 1648. This system marked a significant advancement over earlier intelligence efforts by institutionalizing surveillance within the state's bureaucracy. The Cabinet Noir's operations were remarkably sophisticated for the time, employing techniques that foreshadow modern signals intelligence. Cryptographers, who were trained in mathematics and linguistics, broke complex ciphers that were being used by ambassadors from England, Spain, and the Vatican, decoding messages that revealed military strategies or secret alliances. Richelieu's agents also forged letters to sow discord, a tactic effectively used to destabilize Habsburg coalitions during the 30 Years' War. Beyond diplomacy, the Cabinet Noir monitored domestic correspondence, rooting out dissent among nobles who were opposing Richelieu's centralization of royal power. This focus on both foreign and domestic targets distinguished it from earlier systems, like Cromwell's informant networks in the 1530s, which prioritized local control and aligned it more closely with the comprehensive mandates of later intelligence agencies. Richelieu's personal oversight ensured the system's efficiency, though it depended heavily on his genius and authority.
You know, there's a period of history that we know exists not too far distant, which we are very certain has been lied about. And we have things like cathedrals that exist, some of the most amazing buildings, and we're beginning to realize their form and function was for the good and for the healing and for the higher mindedness of the people who lived there. And yet that's been lied about. It can't be known in our time how that there was possibly a culture that was much happier and higher minded than we currently are, hidden from us. And it makes me ask the question, can we get to a culture that has good and decency, where we treat living things with respect and treat one another with respect, when the very power structures that now run everything through the guise of corporation or a non-existent entity which has been granted the rights of a person, is it possible to get there? And luckily, I'm aware of natural science and the idea of elements and what nature tells me to be true. And therefore, I comprehend that all constructed things will see their end. It reminds me of the old cliche, the best laid plans of mice and men, and these types of ideas. But look how far back we're supposedly looking, where the power structure is doing everything that would be viewed as unacceptable by the citizenry, if that's a word to even use. And we're there now. Right now, we're there. It's crazy to think about, but I'll close with this idea. Sometimes you wake up in the morning in the modern era and the weight of what's going on around us can really weigh you down, but I never forget that I don't have it nearly as bad as the people who have gone to the dark side. In my view, they have slaved themselves out. They are not free to do whatever they want, and they are beholden. And I have agreed to no such contract, if that's even the right word. And in the long run, I think that's going to be the difference between who comes out on top and who loses. Is there anything you want to add about these notes before we take a break for hour two, Jason?
Well, I was quite impressed with how much I learned from looking all this stuff up. I was not aware of how much that intelligence agencies and intelligence gathering was so integrated into so many of these times gone by. I was very impressed with that. So when we get back, we're going to be looking at the 18th century and the significant European colonial expansion that's going on. And again, bigger empires means bigger networks needed.
It's a funny thing. We're handed these histories and hardly ever do we look at the map and look at that tiny place called England and say, how in the hell did this little thumbprint on the map gain control of so much? And in my view, part of it is exactly what I alluded to. They've got secret dark weapons that they bring to bear that decent people would have nothing to do with. Because if that's not true, how could any of this be possible? Control by so few of so many. But then again, we're standing in a world right now where corporations are running everything and precious few literally have control of every major system that it takes for us to get along in a day. But that too will be worked out in short order, I would imagine, before another century goes by. With that, hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. We're starting to run live streams, both live and some of our old, really popular episodes on YouTube. So keep your eye open for that. Members of the website get access to all the comments and forums, and they can create top-level topics. They can stream the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon anytime they want. That has 10 awards in the world, and we are beginning to think about the next film, which will cover the solar work I've been doing. And this is apex, in my view. There's no bigger idea, in my view. Anyhow, there are solar stills available to everybody, and members of crow777radio.com get exclusive access to my solar work. It's not shown anywhere but to membership. With that, we're going to take a short break and we'll see you very shortly for hour two. I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers. We'll be right back.
is the enemy of knowing.